10 plus 1. Number 1, Tom Hanks. Number 2, Sandra Bullock. Number 3, Denzel Washington. Number 4, Meryl Streep. Number 5, Maya Angelou. Number 6, Steven Spielberg. Number 7, Bill Gates. Number 8, Alex Trebek. Number 9, Melinda Gates. Number 10, Julia Roberts. Number 11, Dr. Robert Lefkowitz. Now, there are several shocking things to discuss here. First and most obvious, Sandra Bullock is number 2. In my book, she's number 1. She and I go way back to when we were both just starting out. We did Demolition Man and 2 If by C together. So I may be biased, but you know what? Fuck it. I am biased. I don't know Tom Hanks, but I know you could hand your car keys to Sandra Bullock and say, go pick up 2 cases of beer and some vodka, and she would not only do it, no questions asked, she'd be back in a flash. At least in the old days. Would Tom Hanks do that? He looks like the kind of guy who wouldn't. He seems like he would try to talk you out of partying and hold on to your keys in case you drank too much. Which, come to think of it, is probably why he's number 1. Okay, I get it now. He stays. The second most obvious shocker, that I came in at number 57. I'm kidding. I wasn't number 57. I was 94. Sorry, totally fucking with you now. I'm not on the list. Or probably even anywhere in the top 1,000. And I shouldn't be. Neither should Sandy or Tom, or Denzel. No actors should be. Never mind 5 actors in the first 10 spots. And if that isn't bad enough, Alex Trebek at number 8? Seriously? He doesn't actually know the answers to the questions, folks. He's just really, really good at reading them off of index cards. And he's a Canadian who doesn't fucking skate anymore, which would put him even higher than 8 on the 100 least trusted Canadians list. The real shocker in this poll, though, is number 11, Dr. Robert Lefkowitz. Not because he's the only doctor on the list and should have finished even higher, but I'm shocked that people actually know who the guy is. A Nobel Prize-winning chemist. I'm not buying his notoriety here. Unless he appeared on Dr. Oz, who came in 16th, or on Oprah, who somehow came in 46th. Which just goes to show you how quickly you lose leverage once you're no longer on TV every day. How would you like to win the Nobel Prize for your staggering work as a medical genius who has devoted your entire life to research that will save other human lives, but lose a trust competition to a fucking Canadian game show host? USA! USA! Take it from a famous actor. We shouldn't be on this list. Why? Because we suck. All right? We're only good at memorizing lines and staring at ourselves in the mirror. The only things we can be trusted to do are lie about our age and how great our current project is. We care more about frown lines than we do about melting ice caps. And we may have stopped wearing fur and promised not to eat meat anymore, but if there's a new neck cream that's made out of seal semen and actually gets rid of wrinkles, hand us the baseball bats because we're heading for the fucking beach. The top 10 spots on that list should consist of firefighters and soldiers, police officers and nurses, teachers and EMTs and community service volunteers, people who do dangerous and devoted work, people who live their lives thinking about helping others. Actors don't think about anyone except other actors who are getting paid more than they are, or have better plastic surgeons and bigger houses. Okay, I'm painting with a very big brush here. Not every actor is a cunt or a dink, and a lot of them have spent part of their fame raising a ton of money for many great charitable causes, which, as far as I'm concerned, makes them very cool. Listen, I thought getting famous would make me cool. It didn't. It put me in rooms with cool people where I usually ended up making a fool of myself. Fate? Probably. Reminding me never to forget from whence I came. The attic of that 2.5-decker at One Benefit Terrace in Maine, South Worcester, Mass. Believe me, I've never gotten over the thrill of being around show business legends. Every couple of years when I'm at a charity gala or award show and hear someone say, "Hey Dennis, how's things?" and turn around to find Tony Bennett waiting for an answer, my knees buckle. Once a year at least, I'm in the same room with Robert De Niro, and he always has a cell phone photo or two he wants to show me. He scrolls, and I smile. It never gets old, and I hope it never does. But like I said, fame is a disease. It makes rich assholes born on third base think they hit a triple. It turns action movie airheads into budget-cutting icons. But one way or another, the flawed mighty always fall. by declaring bankruptcy on 40 failing properties but not their own pussy-groping soul, or marrying a Kennedy and then knocking up the maid. As a celebrity doctor, diagnosing this fame flu is my area of expertise. So I'm going to call it my shit don't stink disease, MSDS for short. And I tell all my patients who suffer from MSDS the same thing. Yes, it does. As a matter of fact, your shit stinks so bad they can smell it on fucking Mars. MSDS hits famous actors and athletes, presidents and preachers, even Diego from Ice Age. Whenever I feel the symptoms of MSDS fever coming on, I always recall that old proverb, physician, heal thyself, which I'm trying my best to do. What pill do I prescribe? Hanging out with people far more famous than I am. That seems to put me right back in my proper place. Let me give you an example. Nothing prepared me for being this awesome. Bill Murray. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Rod Stewart. I was asked to host an event billed as Fashion Rock several times during the 2000s. The show was sponsored by Condé Nast and raised money for various causes each year through a live concert melding music stars and famed fashion designers, which was televised around the world. The first one was held at the Royal Albert Hall in London, co-hosted by Elizabeth Hurley and me to benefit the Prince's Trust, with 17 performers and 17 fashion designers all on one stage. The show was broadcast live on TV in Europe, meaning entrances and exits were timed right down to the very second, and the performers were ferried off and on stage at a breakneck pace, with pauses only for the occasional 2 or 3 minute commercial breaks. My old friend, acting partner, and future Rescue Me co-star John Skurdy was my personally chosen co-writer for that concert, feeding me lines and ideas as the evening unfolded. And it went swimmingly, including a gag John handed me seconds before a live backstage interview with Michael Stipe, who had chosen to wear a mask of powder blue fluorescent eye makeup that covered his eyes and nose and wrapped around the sides and back of his shaven head. It was quite bright and painstakingly applied. Skurdy saw the getup and, as the camera was about to roll, walked over and whispered a few words into my ear, thus leading to my first on-camera question for Michael. Hey, man, what happened? Did you blow a smurf? The line got a huge laugh, including one from Stipe himself. When I met Prince Charles after the show, he even referenced the gag and began guffawing all over again. That was an unexpected show business thrill, the Crown Prince of England discussing a blowjob joke. Don't get much better than that. The evening was a massive success, and the following year Condé Nast decided to make it an annual show and bring it to the United States using a live-to-tape approach, this time with me hosting solo. In 2004, at Radio City Music Hall, my dressing room was located just off the stage, where Skurdy sat at a computer coming up with new joke ideas based on the flow of the show, and where I had quick access to him and my cigarettes. It wasn't a large room, but it was big enough for us to commiserate momentarily after I had introduced an act. Nerves were not a factor. I'd already played Radio City on my own, and one of the singular greatest thrills of my career happened there. The stage has three elevated platforms that can each descend 30 feet below stage level. As we were introduced, the band and I were already in place, unseen by the audience, and began playing the opening chords to the Asshole song, Two Stories Below. Slowly but surely, we rose up into view as the crowd went crazy. They exploded again as we went into the first chorus because, unplanned by us, our stage designer had 25-foot-high letters light up behind us, spelling out the word asshole in bright, sparkling white. The entire band shared a huge smile and then finished what may have been the loudest, most exuberant version of the tune we ever gave. Turns out we had another surprise on Rod Stewart night. The audience was not made aware in advance of the fact that Ron Wood would be appearing on stage to play guitar as Rod sang Maggie May and Stay With Me. First, I would introduce Rod and he would sing a number from his current album. Then there would be a 3 minute commercial break during which Rod would change outfits and I would go back on stage to introduce him and Ron. I hadn't met Rod Stewart before. I missed him at soundcheck that afternoon and so far during the course of my career had never had the opportunity to make his acquaintance. But let me just ruminate for a few paragraphs on Rod, one of the greatest and most unique voices in the history of rock and roll. I first became enamored of his talent in 1971 when his solo album Every Picture Tells a Story came out, followed very quickly by The Face's most recent album featuring Rod on vocals. Two great works in one short year, giving us within an eight-month span the now classic songs Maggie May, Reason to Believe, I Know I'm Losing You, and, as if those three killers weren't enough, Stay With Me. I was also a rabid Boston Bruins hockey fan, and the TV broadcasts of their games used the intro of I Know I'm Losing You as the Bruins theme song. Someone in the Bruins organization was hip to the current hottest tunes. At that time, my older brother Johnny and I lived in the basement of our parents' new ranch house in the Hadwin Park neighborhood of Worcester, Massachusetts. We shared a small room next to the water heater. I've written and spoken about that room numerous times. It was very cramped and covered in paneling. The walls, the ceiling, the closet, every single inch was paneled. My parents loved paneling. If they could have paneled the backyard, they would have. The whole interior of the house was shrouded in it. The two upstairs bedrooms, the living room we weren't allowed to sit in because the furniture was, quote, too nice, unquote, and encased in plastic. Even the one bathroom we all shared had tile in the shower, wallpaper on one wall, and the rest, you guessed it, paneling. I never understood the theory behind covering your best furniture with plastic. That's like buying a Ralph Lauren suit, keeping it in a giant see-through Ziploc bag, and bringing it out to show everyone during Thanksgiving as if to say, isn't this nice? Doesn't it look expensive? Too expensive to actually wear, right? Here, take a picture of me holding it, and then it goes right back into the closet. So my brother Johnny and I slept in what was essentially an 8x16-foot wood-paneled coffin. The only part of our cellar bedroom that managed to escape such 70s-style Irish-American interior design was the floor, which sported a basic worn-out yellow batch of indoor-outdoor carpeting. It was tight quarters and had only a sliver of low light that managed to snake in for maybe 2 hours per day through a tiny rectangular ground-level window that sat close to the ceiling. But we had our own entrance, the basement door, which led to the backyard and an alley out to the street so we could come and go as we pleased, which is important when you're 14 years old and already smoking, drinking, and chasing girls. We also had our own refrigerator, an old late 50s rat box that had seen better days but served as my parents' storage space for guest beer, the good stuff they'd serve when we had visitors. My brother and I drank that beer as if it was holy water, which, in a way, it was, because we'd already decided the Catholic school we were serving time in was preaching a bunch of impractical bullshit. Fuck the church. That dirty downstairs room was our sanctuary. We could smoke and drink and parse the problems of the planet and puberty and pot and chicks and politics while listening to Hendrix, The Who, The Stones, Marvin Gaye, Bowie, Zeppelin, Lennon, McCartney, Sly and the Family Stone, The Kinks, anyone and anything we wanted. Sometimes Johnny and I would have conflicting appetites in music. For instance, he dug Crosby, Stills, Nash, and not nearly enough Neil Young for my taste. But we both absolutely adored Rod Stewart and the Faces. In 1971, that meant playing both of their new albums incessantly, until the grooves were so worn down the needle was almost nipping the turntable. By virtue of being broke and not well connected enough, we never had the chance to see Rod Stewart in his prime. As we got older, he became an elusive live concert get for us, our often empty wallets and his expensive show schedules never lining up. Until 1993. I had just gotten famous and was invited to be the only comedian to perform on MTV's critically acclaimed and extremely popular Unplugged series with my band The Assholes from No Cure for Cancer. The Asshole song had become a hit, and several other comedy tunes on the album were getting airplay, plus a few new ones like Life's Gonna Suck, Love Barge, and Save This, which would appear on my second album, Lock and Load. The Unplugged episodes were filmed three at a time on a large Los Angeles soundstage. The set designers would slightly alter the look and lighting of the stage for each show, and the star dressing rooms were actually two large Winnebagos parked behind it. Our trio of shows consisted of Neil Young on Tuesday night, Rod on Wednesday, and my band on Thursday. So the Assholes and I decided to fly into L.A. early to rehearse and watch Rod tape his Unplugged, which was a tremendous mistake. Rod took the crowd on a tour of his greatest hits, but what really stunned us was the magnitude of his charisma. With Ron Wood on guitar, Rod's signature sexy rasp brought the house down. It was a masterclass in professional musicianship, stage presence, and the tease, bringing the audience oh so slowly to the edge of teary-eyed orgasm on the slow numbers, and then kicking their collective ass with a dose of rocket fuel on the big rollicking hits, without ever missing a note. It was a powerful reminder that no matter where the musical times may lead us and what style of auto-tuned, lip-sunk techno crap may temporarily take over the airwaves, the artists who really gain longevity all share the same DNA. Live chops. The only break Rod took in 2 hours of top-notch entertainment came at the end of each song, when he and Ronnie would quickly gulp down some water out of red solo cups and then kick off the next number. Watching Rod perform put a pit in our stomachs, because the next night, we'd be up on that same stage, trying to entertain thousands with my much weaker set of raspy talents on lead vocals. Rod's Rock and Roll Hall of Fame voice has been described as, quote, bedroom soul meeting street smart balls, unquote. The only part of that phrase you could apply to my voice would be the word balls, as in, I can't believe this guy has the balls to get up in front of people and sing. So we scurried away before the encore without going backstage to meet Rod and Ronnie. All of us assholes riding to the hotel, feeling more than a little queasy. The next day we arrived at the stage for soundcheck, with almost no testosterone pissing through our nervous veins, wondering how we could have ever booked a gig following two such towering rock icons. We piled into the main Winnebago, and when our guitar player Adam Roth asked me for a bottle opener for his soda, the first four kitchen drawers I tried each had an empty vodka pint rattling around inside. What the fuck are all these empties from? I asked the MTV producer who was giving us the run-of-show breakdown. Oh, sorry, we forgot to clean them out, he answered. Rod and Ronnie promised their wives they wouldn't drink last night, and we poured vodka into their onstage cups instead of water so they wouldn't get caught. Then the wives came backstage like right after the final number, so we had to hide the evidence real fucking fast. That fact brought us right back down to earth. We started laughing our balls off so hard they dropped out of our scared stomachs and right back into their normal sack positions. Turns out, Rod and Ronnie were really just two regular guys trying to avoid getting busted by their better halves, just like the rest of us. Needless to say, our nerves were immediately settled. Our Unplugged went great and got massive ratings, and the live version of Life's Gonna Suck became a cult classic. Anyway, back to Radio City Music Hall in 2004. Where I still hadn't met Rod Stewart. Ron Wood and I had met and hung out together quite a bit at this point, which is part of another chapter on the Rolling Stones. But on this night, on a show that included such music legends as Alicia Keys, Beyonce, and Usher, Rod Stewart was the only one I didn't have the chance to meet face-to-face before the 8 o'clock curtain. His dressing room was floors above my little nook off the side of the stage. At one point, I saw him in the distance, down a hallway, greeting a clearly nervous Beyonce, who took a few pictures with him. I was about to make my way toward them when the stage manager grabbed me and said it was time to kick things off. As I said 33 paragraphs ago, sorry, my mind does wander, this show was live to tape, meaning it might as well be a live concert because the only time the director would yell cut would be for a major fuck-up. Otherwise, the few breaks in the two-hour extravaganza would be for commercials they would insert later on. My job as host was to keep the audience laughing after each artist finished and while the stage crew swept one set away and placed the next band's stuff in position. The first four or five acts did great. Avril Lavigne, the Black Eyed Peas, the Goo Goo Dolls guy. Alicia Keys had the crowd in the palm of her hand. Usher had them dancing and swooning. Beyonce murdered the room. Murdered it. Killed it and skinned it and buried what was left. As I stepped up to the mic to introduce Rod Stewart for his first number, I briefly got a gander of him in the wings and wondered if he was worried about following her. Nope, he had a smile on his face, chatting happily away with a PA and drinking some water or vodka maybe. So I said his name. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Rod Stewart. And the place was resurrected. That is the sign of a real star. Beyonce had destroyed the room a scant few moments before, but just the mention of Rod Stewart's name brought 6,000 souls right back to life and onto their feet. It was amazing to watch. Which I only did for a few seconds because I had to go check in with Skirty, who was still sitting at the computer and watching Rod's performance on our backstage monitor. He was about to hand me an idea for a Beyonce joke when we were interrupted by an attractive woman bearing a bunch of clothes on wooden hangers. She said, I'm sorry to waltz in, but would it be all right if Rod Stewart changes outfits in here during the commercial break? His dressing room's on the fifth floor, and it would just be impossible for him to get all the way up there and back down in time for his second entrance. John and I looked at each other, and I said, no problem. We acted like it was the most normal thing in the world. Matter of fact, we barely paid attention, as if having a rock legend take over our space was something that happened to us all the time. Hey, whatever Rod needs, I said, like I knew him already. She thanked us and then hung a canary yellow sport coat, neon orange dress shirt, and a pair of jeans worth more than my father ever made in a year on the hooks next to my stuff. Then she tenderly placed a pair of blood orange sneakers with neon orange stripes on the floor below, said thank you oh so much, and left. So Skirty and I did what any normal person would do under the same circumstances. We waited about half a second just to make sure she was gone, and then ran over to the clothes and stared at them, focused in like two fashion detectives in search of some kind of clothing clue. We felt the jacket and were in awe of how soft it was. We touched the shirt, even softer than the jacket. Then we caressed the jeans, which were like silky silk, like silken silky silk. We were still smiling and stroking Rod's jeans like two 16-year-old girls when Skirty said, hey, before we grab our shit and give Rod the room, let me show you a couple of joke ideas for the finale. And so we crossed over to the table and sat down in front of his laptop when the crowd erupted in applause, and we realized Rod must have finished his first number. So we looked at the monitor when, boom, the door flew open and in rushed Rod fucking Stewart with a glass of wine in his hand, downing a huge slug of it as he entered, then saying this, hello, Dennis. How's it going, mate? Rod Stewart knew my name. Rod Stewart said my name. I wanted to whip out my cell phone and call my brother. Instead, I decided to answer Rod and moved to leave when he whipped off his jacket and vest, took another slug of wine and said this, you lads don't mind me changing in here, do you? And as I muttered, not at all, he kicked off his shoes, pulled off his tie, and started unbuttoning his shirt as he said this, Dennis, are you bringing me and Ronnie straight out or doing some time before us? He said my name again. Holy shit, I really wanted to call my brother now. Instead, I said, whatever, whatever you want, Rod. This is John, by the way. Hello, Johnny boy. Bring us right up then, Den. Ronnie's preset, so when the curtain opens, the crowd will see him revealed and then go fucking crazy. He called me Den. Wow, only my family and my wife call me Den. My brother was getting a phone call before this night was over. He would flip out. Listen, at this point in my career, I'd met and even worked with a lot of monumental movie stars, De Niro, Dustin Hoffman, Clint Eastwood, and hung out with many of my musical heroes, like The Stones and Elvis Costello and Willie Nelson, not to mention become friends with my personal comedy kings, George Carlin and Richard Pryor. But each and every time I meet someone from such a talented stratosphere, I'm still very much impressed. I shoot right back to that basement bedroom where my brother and I were inspired by these people and spent hour after hour listening to or watching them and then day after day discussing their work. Meanwhile, Rod kept removing clothing. He took off his shirt and in one fell swoop for what felt like less than a nanosecond, unbuckled his belt, dropped his pants around his ankles and stepped out of them. Rod Stewart was now standing buck naked in front of us. Let me repeat that. Rod Stewart. Naked. Cock and balls naked. And then ass, because he turned around. And then cock and balls again, as he decided to gulp down the remainder of his wine and walk toward us. Skirty and I froze in seated positions as Rod Stewart's crotch waltzed across the room, headed right for our table. This is as good a time as any to discuss the unwritten guy's rule of looking at another guy's cock. You just never do it. In a hockey locker room with 25 guys undressing and 24 wangs for your eyes to accidentally glimpse, you avert your gaze. In a shared backstage dressing room, you quickly look elsewhere. Anywhere. Your shoes, your shirt, your cell phone. When I do arena concerts, my band comes with me, and that's a minimum of 8 guys plus me changing before and after a show. But even among such old friends, you do not stare at the dicks. That's the rule. It's not always easy. With so much manhood flailing around in such crowded confines, your line of sight is bound to find an occasional cock in its crosshairs. And the polite thing to do is look away or make immediate eye contact with the owner and start talking about sports or chicks or booze, anything except what just happened. Nobody ever wrote this rule down. Nobody makes an announcement when you turn 13. Your father doesn't pass it along as important inside info while he's teaching you how to drive. It's just understood. You don't focus on the dicks. A lesson I've learned so well that even when given the chance to notice another celebrity sausage, I abstain. I once took a piss shoulder to shoulder with John Hamm in a men's room at the White House Correspondents' Dinner and walked away knowing only this. A, he's taller than you think. B, he's a big St. Louis Cardinals fan. C, Don Draper has dreamy green eyes. Did I know John was holding 12 inches of ham in his paws? Nope. Just like you, I read about it in the papers a couple of years later. But imagine if I was the one who slipped that poll profile to a room full of D.C. media mavens. I would have been banned from every famous men's room faster than Caitlyn fucking Jenner. I'd be a VIP penis pariah. But Rod Stewart's knob was no TV star skin flute. His was beyond even a Matt Damon major movie meat stick. Rod's was a legendary dong, a knob that had been famous for 5 fucking decades by the time I saw it, which I couldn't avoid doing because I was in a seated position. So Rod Stewart's rod was eye level as it approached me. Not my fault. I have a celebrity sausage, and over the years I've caught a couple guys gazing at it and then quickly making eye contact with me to start talking about the hockey game we just played or the gig we just finished. No big deal. But my penis is a D-level celebrity when compared with Rod Stewart's. His is attached to an actual rock icon. His is in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. His hog is historic. I almost felt an obligation to observe it and report back to the masses, hey, you want to know what Rod Stewart's penis looks like? If you had the opportunity to see Mick Jagger's member or Obama's beef whistle or Derek Jeter's Johnson, wouldn't you give it a glance? Not an ogle, not a gawk, not a wide, eagle-eyed glare, just a glimpse. This was my quandary as Rod Stewart approached us. I have no idea what Skurdy was doing during the next manic 4 seconds, but my brain started making my mouth mumble aloud to Rod about how big a fan I was and what a head of hair you have and blah, blah, blubbity, blah. Well, I swear to Christ, Rod's pecker was almost daring me to dial in on it. Look at me, Leary. Look at me. Look at me now. Take a good, long look, look, look. But my mind was insistent on eye contact, eye contact, eye contact with Rod, and my mouth was still mumbling, and Rod's schlong was still screaming, look at me, Leary, look, look, look. So I looked at it. I didn't give it a glance, not even a glimpse, way shorter than even a half glimpse. It was such a short view, I'd have to invent a new word for it. It was a glance. I glanced it, okay, for maybe a zeptosecond, which is 1/16 of a second, which is not even enough time to really notice anything other than the fact that, yes, it's a penis. And when I swiftly returned my eyes up to Rod's, he seemed to know. This guy just glanced my junk. But instead of saying anything about that, he downed the rest of his wine, bopped the goblet onto the table and said, "You can sell that on eBay, boys." Then he turned around and headed back toward his clothing. I did not get any descriptive details about Rod Stewart's cock. As it turns out, a zeptosecond is so small an amount of time, your mind can't measure what it sees other than to register the object in general. It was a dick, not famous or massive or odd or small or anything except a human penis. That's all I could get. But I will admit that once Rod was walking away, I took a good long fucking look at him, and I can tell you this with 100% absolute certainty. The guy has a great ass. I've never stared at another man's ass longer. It had to be 7 seconds. I mean, that may sound like a long time, but hey, fuck you. I saw it and you didn't. His ass looked firm and round and tight, like 2 oversized grapefruits walking in rhythm. I turned to see what Skurdy was doing, and guess what? Same as me, staring at Rod Stewart's famous, fine ass. And the man was in great shape. He was 59 at the time and had the body of a guy in his 30s. We watched him dress, as he said, "Once we're done, you'll come back on to outro us, yeah?" "Oh, yeah," I said. "I'll let the audience react for a bit. I'm sure you guys will get a standing O." "Well, we shall see, won't we?" he said with a charming smile. God damn, I love this man. Not just his ass, his whole being. Then, in what seemed like a flash, Rod had his silky jeans, orange shirt, yellow jacket, and blood orange sneakers on, and was saying this, "See you out there, Den." And off he went, leaving Skurdy and me alone. I looked at him and raised my eyebrows, waiting for a response. It's important to note here that John Skurdy is a gifted member of that rare breed of actors who are so talented Almost every word of dialogue that trips from their tongues seems to be immediately transformed into spun gold. As Lou on Rescue Me, he captured people's hearts, and I count him as the kind of performer no successful TV series can work without. He can make you laugh, cry, and fear for your life all in one scene. Brilliant and beguiling, comedy, drama, small scenes, and lengthy monologues, it matters not what assignment he has to tackle. Skurdy can make it sound like the dialogue was delivered to him directly from the gods above. And he goes deep, deep enough to improvise in character and make the words he was given disappear, to be replaced by ones funnier, prettier, heavier, and just plain better. He's also a terrific writer and one of the most hilarious people on the planet. Having known him for decades, there was never a time, on set or off, funeral or celebration, casual dinner or formal gala event, where he wasn't able to utter something that would make me laugh my ass off. Except right now. He just stared back at me, speechless. The stage manager stuck his head in the door and said, "We gotta go, Dennis. We haven't had a time stoppage all night. Let's not start now." And so off I went. It was true. The show so far had been a dream. Smooth as Rod's jeans and without a single mistake. Not once had the director been forced to yell cut. Rod took his place at center stage behind the curtain as I strolled confidently to my mark. The lights came on and the audience applauded. Their excitement was palpable and infectious. 6,000 true music fans, 12,000 eager eyes. I took a dramatic beat and, like the true professional I am, said, "Ladies and gentlemen, once again, Cock Stewart." To absolute and utter silence. Until this. Cut! I felt like my head was going to explode. Cock? I said Cock Stewart? A ripple of nervous laughter coursed through the first few rows of the crowd. I froze in place and then just announced, Rod Stewart. But to no avail. The mic had gone dead. Apparently somewhere during the words, once again. So nobody heard me say Cock Stewart, except the first few rows of the crowd. But Rod was only a few feet behind me, hidden behind the curtain, yet close enough to have heard what I said. I wanted to pull back the curtain and explain to him what happened, that it was just a nervous accident and not a joke. But a TV technician wearing a headset was suddenly in front of me, replacing my mic with a shake of his head and a smile as he held up five fingers and said, "Bad mic." Apparently, he hadn't heard my mistake either. I exhaled deeply, calmed down, waited for him to finish, which he did by whispering, "Don't say cock this time," as he held up four fingers and counted 4, 3, 2, 1 and pointed at me. Action. This time, I took a big juicy pause, double-checked my brain to make sure the proper words came out of my mouth, and this is what I said. "Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome back, Rod Stewart." And the opening notes of Maggie May began. Jesus Christ, I almost said cock again. And the crowd went crazy. What the fuck is wrong with me? And then the curtain opened, the lights blasted up, and they saw Ronnie Wood, and they went even crazier. Ronnie and Rod killed, just completely demolished the place. And I went on stage afterward and said, "Rod Stewart, everybody." Not cock, not Karad, Rod. And then I said, "How about Ron Wood, ladies and gentlemen?" They both gave me a quick glance. It was hard to tell if Rod was pissed at me with 6,000 people giving him a standing ovation. I figured a backstage apology would be the best move, but unfortunately, that didn't happen. Because I never saw Rod Stewart in person again, which has become a theme in many of my interactions with famous rock stars. In this case, Rod didn't show up at the after party where Skurdy and I laughed about our experience and discussed just how much a wine goblet from a rock god might be worth online. In the end, Skurdy kept the glass, and I kept my memory of Cock Stewart, which, when you think about it, is actually a really great name for a rock and roll singer. When I called my brother, he totally agreed. Since that night, every time I see Rod being welcomed to the stage for a TV appearance or listen as a song of his is played on the radio, I think of him as Cock Stewart. And now, so will you. You're welcome. Even with this kind of damage already done in celebrity circles, some of my fans only half-jokingly still want me to run for the Oval Office. Do you really want a president who might accidentally mention cock on TV? Oh, wait. We already have that guy who referred to his own. On purpose. Listen, we have many examples of famous people who hung their Hollywood hats on some political star and not only pulled it off, but did so with graceful aplomb. On both sides of the aisle. Al Franken and Fred Thompson. Jesse Ventura and Ronald Reagan. Oscar winner Glenda Jackson served in Parliament for 23 years, earning plaudits for tirelessly representing her constituents and staying devoted to their cause. Child star Shirley Temple became a trusted American foreign ambassador and served as a highly respected delegate to the United Nations General Assembly for Republican and Democratic administrations alike, drawing much acclaim as a bipartisan patriot. Will Trump one day join that pantheon? The jury is out, but I sure won't. Why? Keep listening. You're not famous until my mother knows who you are. Jay Leno. Beyonce and me. Yep, you got that chapter title right. It's not a typo. I know Beyonce. And if I ever need a lesson in fame humility, hanging around with her hands it to me tenfold. She's not just famous. Queen Bey is an artist so beloved that she occupies exalted air, and very deservedly so. Let me tell you how we first met. The 2008 Fashion Rocks concert at Radio City was probably the biggest one I ever did. The money raised was earmarked for Stand Up to Cancer, and the lineup was absolutely insane. Carrie Underwood, Mary J. Blige, Rihanna, Debbie Harry, Fergie, the Black Eyed Peas, Justin Timberlake, Miley Cyrus, Natasha Bedingfield, Ciara, Duffy, Leona Lewis, Mariah Carey, Ashanti, Keisha Cole, Kid Rock, Solange, Keith Urban, Pussycat Dolls, and Leonard fucking Skinnert. Plus, reprise video performances from previous Fashion Rocks events, including Bryan Adams tearing up the Royal Albert Hall in 2003, David Bowie returning to the stage after a long absence to sing Life on Mars alone, and 5 years in tandem with Arcade Fire from 2005, and Elton John hosting the show in 2006. And three different helpings of Beyonce. Beyonce doing a tribute to Etta James, Beyonce doing a duet with Justin Timberlake on the old Marvin Gaye and Tammy Terrell tune, Ain't Nothing Like the Real Thing, and Beyonce joining some of the other female stars for a version of the charity single, Just Stand Up. My daughter Devin was 16 at the time, and was not only the world's biggest Beyonce fan, but had never seen her live. So as the host of the show, I made sure she and five of her Beyonce fanatic friends had front row seats. Which got me major dad points. Not to mention the ultra-major dad points I would earn if I could introduce Devin to her musical hero. Which I figured was bound to happen, since Queen Bey was doing so much material in the course of the show, plus the red carpet, which Devin and I would also be walking. Somewhere in that five-hour window, I was bound to meet Bey and bring Devin to her attention. Even though Beyonce had performed at the earlier Cox Stewart Fashion Rocks, we never met face-to-face or stood anywhere near each other. Her intros that night were done by an offstage announcer, and she ghosted as soon as her final number was finished. But on this particular night, I was not leaving the building without making sure she knew who I was. And if all else failed, there was a secret backdoor escape route all the celebrities would be taking as we left the event and went to the massive afterparty. Dev and I could always just wait there until Beyonce headed out and casually introduce ourselves. Or even better yet, have Beyonce stop and compliment my performance. Which I figured was going to happen because I had a fantastic gag set up as the centerpiece of my hosting job. My talented friend and highly respected comedian Jeff Cesario was co-writer on this gig. And among the bevy of great ideas he had was one playing off the fashion angle. My stylist, Sam Spector, mentioned to us that several designers were willing to comp me clothes if I wore their stuff on camera during the concert. Jeff's pitch was, I would walk out and explain to the audience that each time I mentioned a designer's name, I'd get to keep the clothes I was currently wearing. All of it. Head to toe. At the end of the opening monologue, I did that setup and finished with, for instance, this suit is from John Varvatos and now it's all mine. A few performances later, I came out in a different suit, said thank you, Hugo Boss, as I modeled it and pointed comically down at my shoes while purring, created by Kenneth Cole, ladies and gentlemen. Then I introduced the Bryan Adams kick-ass performance from the first Fashion Rocks. The payoff came a little later when I stumbled out in $2,000, 6-inch-high Christian Louboutin stiletto heels wearing a front-plunging $9,000 Gucci gold gown, Harry Winston diamond earrings worth $75,000 each, and a chunky Cartier diamond bracelet that cost twice as much as my daughter's college education. After walking with some difficulty to center stage, I stood at the mic for a moment, and tried to fix my double nip slip, which was almost impossible. Then, frozen there, in all my designer glory, I sighed with exasperation and said, "My wife called." Big laugh. Big laugh. But the story of that outfit starts earlier in the evening. I had asked Sam to find me something I could get in and out of quickly, since I'd have exactly 12 minutes to travel from the stage to my fifth-floor dressing room, change, and head back down again. It would be the 2003 Bryan Adams video, which was about 4 minutes of rock and roll fury from his airtight three-piece band, then a Beyoncé live performance introduced by my pre-recorded voice, then a commercial break before my voice introed Mary J. Blige. And after the dress gag, I'd have about the same amount of time to get back upstairs and put on another suit. Sam came up with a dress that looked so small when he first pulled it out of his bag that I thought it was a tube top. "It's Keira Knightley's gown from the Pirates of the Caribbean premiere," he explained. "It's kind of iconic because she got a lot of press in that dress." Keira Knightley? Holy shit. I'd seen the pictures of her in it. Who hadn't? They were everywhere after that event. She looked stunning and small, as did the dress Sam handed me. It was very gold and very shiny and tiny as hell. "I can't fit into that fucking thing, Sam. Plus, it's way too fancy. I need a funny dress." Cesario was in the room and very much in agreement with me. "All he needs is a gag dress, something that's not so," and here Jeff searched for the correct comedy expert word, "not so, clingy." "Yes, not too clingy," I chimed in. "Clingy isn't funny on a guy. Leave it to Sam Spector to put us in our place." "Listen, guys," he said, "clingy is funny. I know fashion, and I know what's funny about fashion. If you walk out there in any old dress, this crowd won't laugh. If you walk out there in a glamorous, close-fitting gown, all dolled up like the other girls on stage tonight, you will get a lot of laughs, because it looks like a dress every woman would kill to wear. This dress is funny. The fact that Keira made the dress famous already, and that a man is wearing it, makes it all the more hilarious. Same thing with the accessories, shoes, earrings, the clutch, they all make it funnier, because they're things women really want to wear. Now go try on the gown." 5 words no one on earth had ever said to me before. Go try on the gown. Which I did. My dressing room was small and overpopulated, so the easiest place to change was the men's room across the hall. There was a security guard outside that door to guarantee me privacy. I changed into the gown and took a glance at myself in the mirror. I looked like Bruce Jenner before he became Caitlyn, only with a much bigger nose. But guess what? As soon as I walked back into my dressing room, Jeff, Sam, the hair and makeup girls, and the security guard outside my door all started laughing their asses off. Sam was right, and full of other info after I peeled off the gown and stood there in my boxers. "You can't wear boxers underneath," Sam said. "It ruins the line of the dress. You need to wear a thong." "A thong? If you wear a thong, your balls won't be cold. If you go commando, expect a draft. And the dress is so clingy, people will see the outline of your penis through it." I sighed with acceptance. Sam said it's a very soft satin thong, so your balls will be cozy. Your balls will be cozy. 5 more words I'd never heard before. Having just learned he was an expert about drag, I took Sam's advice. By the way, that's really what a thong is when it's worn by a man. A ball cozy. So come the appointed time during the show, I'd have to rush off stage, take an elevator to the 5th floor, grab the dress, jewels, and thong, run into the men's room, and change from Dennis into Denise. I stood there in my boxers mulling over these facts and the insane timing of it all. That's when I heard this. "Oh my God, I wish I had your legs," my makeup artist Amy said. "What?" I replied. "They're so long and lean. You'd look great in a miniskirt." "Wait a minute. What? Maybe you should shave them. You're shitting me, right?" "No, they're unbelievable. I'd kill to have them, but they won't look their best unless you shave them." "I'm not shaving my fucking legs, Amy." Cesario chimed in. "You do have amazing legs, man. Seriously." Sam said, "I'm going to get you a miniskirt for later in the show." Amy said, "You should definitely shave if you wear a skirt." Then Cesario said, "Totally. Otherwise, it'll ruin the look." I said, "Guys, forget it. I'm not wearing a miniskirt. Ever. And stop staring at my legs." Cesario said, "Dude, you have girl legs. Embrace it. You know how hilarious you would look in a miniskirt? Or a bikini?" I could see the comedy future flashing before my eyes, so I drew a line in the sand. I am never, repeat, never, ever, ever getting a bikini wax. It was easy to notice that Jeff, Sam, and Amy knew otherwise. In a battle between bikini wax and belly laughs would always win. Imagine me on stage at Radio City Music Hall one day in a bikini and high heels with perfectly oiled and long spray-tanned girl-type legs. Just for a sec. Got the image? Good. Glad I could be of comedy service. Now back to our present situation. Cut to halfway through the 2008 show when it's time for me to make my move. I introduced the Bryan Adams video from the first Fashion Rocks back in 2003. He stole the show that night. Just him, his bass player, and his drummer. Three great musicians who sounded like 10. Bryan sang "The Only Thing That Looks Good on Me Is You" as a series of statuesque, drop-dead gorgeous models strutted by in designer duds. Bryan ran around that stage like a madman, his band gunning the beat behind him as he brought the audience to its feet, a performance for the ages and one so electric it still shot adrenaline through Radio City 5 years later. While it was playing, I rushed into the elevator and up to the fifth floor. Cut to the men's room. I'm inside a stall, tearing off my Hugo Boss suit and stepping into the Gucci gown, crowning it all off by pulling on my testicle cozy. I had the earrings and bracelet on already, and about 5 minutes left before I had to be back downstairs. Sam was stationed outside the men's room door keeping watch and listening in case I needed help or advice. Turns out, I badly needed both. I don't know how the hell anyone can wear a thong and feel comfortable, especially if you have balls. Mine just wouldn't fit. I wriggled and wrangled and adjusted and readjusted and re-readjusted and no fucking go. Whenever I got my gonads tucked inside the insanely tiny pouch, my penis refused to be a part of the plan, and vice versa. "Hurry up, Dennis, they're asking for you downstairs," Sam said from the hallway. Ugh. The clock was ticking and my cock wasn't cooperating, and I grunted in frustration as I heard Sam enter the bathroom, so I screamed, "God damn it! My balls won't stay in unless my cock stays out, and my cock only stays in if my balls spill out the side." I threw open the door of the stall and came flying out to confront him with, "Not to mention my ass feels like it's being flossed with a fucking extension cord." To which Justin Timberlake said, okay. I repeat, Justin Timberlake. The Justin Timberlake, who was, apparently, just trying to take a piss, and who now had an upset, on the verge of tears, bejeweled, grown fucking man in a gown and high heels staring at him. I'd never met Justin before, and I've never seen him since. Probably because the next thing I said was this. "Hey, Justin, huge fan. Listen, you've probably dressed up like a chick before, right? Did you go commando or thong? Here, let me take the thong off and you tell me if you can see the outline of my cock and ball sack through the dress." So I pulled up the gown and started pulling down the thong. "Can I ask you another question and please be brutally honest? Do I have girl legs? Huh? Do I?" Then I modeled for him. Thong in hand, gown pulled up, twirled around slowly, smiled, and said, "Well?" Only one word can describe the look on Justin Timberlake's face. Troubled, with a capital T. And all he said was, I'd really like to help you out, but I gotta go." And that was it. He left, very quickly. And in came a security guard. "What the fuck? Where's Sam?" I whined. "Taking a picture with Mary J. Blige," the guard explained. "Listen, man, you can't block off the men's room like this, and you can't go upsetting big stars like Justin fucking Timberlake, okay? You do know that was him, right?" I said, "Of course I know he's Justin fucking Timberlake, and now Justin fucking Timberlake is going to think I'm totally batshit crazy," I said, standing there in my fabulous dress and glittering jewelry, holding my oh-so-satiny thong. The guard gave me a glare. I gave him one back. And then we both started laughing hysterically. Needless to say, on went the ball cozy, and down the hall into the elevator went Denise. Now, for a couple of floors, it was just me, Jeff, Sam, Amy, and a production assistant from the show. I was busy trying to get comfortable in my crotch and butt area while also trying not to fall off my heels. Suddenly, I had a whole new appreciation for what it's like to be a woman. Walking in stiletto heels made me feel as though I was balancing on a steel circus high wire, one that also ran right up my ass crack. My chest was exposed to the air conditioning, which meant my nipples were harder than Vin Diesel's head as they popped against the top of my gown, and the diamond clusters on my ears started itching as they dragged each lobe closer to my collarbones. Plus, everyone was staring at different parts of me. My tits, my legs, my dick, my ass. I was being objectified. "Hey guys," I said, My eyes are up here. We're not worried about your eyes, Jeff explained. The elevator doors opened to reveal Kid Rock and Leonard fucking Skinnerd, beers in hand, headed up to their dressing rooms. 8 sets of eyes wider than supersized Frisbees. Holy shit, Kid Rock exclaimed. You look hot, man. One of the guys from Skinnerd looked me up and down. Damn, look at them little titties. And then as we walked away, I heard, nice ass, sister, and they chuckled their way into the elevator as we rushed toward the wings. It was truly a mind-bending moment. Believe me, when I was in high school and dreaming of being famous one day, having my ass ogled by Leonard fucking Skinnerd wasn't on my celebrity bucket list. I felt slightly demeaned and disgusted. I wanted to turn around on my very high heels and scream, hey, Skinnerd, first of all, my tits ain't that small, okay? For a tall, skinny guy, I'm in pretty good shape, and my tits are well-defined. Second of all, you just said I had a nice ass, but I guess that isn't good enough for you, huh? Well, get a load of these legs, motherfucker. A lot of girls would kill for these legs. Yeah, I was having some pretty strange thoughts. My iris was up and my temper was flaring, so it was becoming kind of clear. If I had been born a girl, I'd have great legs, a nice ass, and very small tits. So what? Kira had small tits and a fantastic ass and shorter legs than mine, but was considered one of the hottest women on earth. Who needs big tits? Not Kira, and not me. Besides, I could always buy big tits. You can't really buy a nice ass unless you want a bigger ass. And long legs? God-given. Ain't no surgery for elongated gams. You either got them or you don't. And I do. So there. Fuck you, Leonard Skinnerd. Yeah, I wasn't just having strange thoughts. I was suffering through an actual full-blown identity crisis. But what happened next might have been even stranger. I got to my appointed spot in the wings, ready to make a big entrance. The stagehands were still setting a Chevy Camaro SS V8 in place, from which Debbie Harry would appear during Fergie's performance of the Blondie hit Call Me. I glanced to my right, and there was Debbie, getting ready to climb inside. She saw me, stopped for a second, tilted her head slightly, smiled, and blew me a kiss. As she sat in the car and the door closed, I was in a sudden teenage fog. At age 19, meeting Debbie Harry would have been an impossible idea for my friends and me, both male and female. Every guy I knew in the late 70s had a crush on her, and so did most of the girls. My buddy Adam Roth was already a full-time rock and roll guitar player in a notorious Boston band called the Marshals, and was lucky enough to have seen Debbie up close at CBGB's one night back in 1976, and unable to stop talking about it for 2 years. We were so enamored and obsessed with her that when our friend Michelle announced that the record store she worked in was about to get 2 life-size cardboard cutouts of Debbie, one for the floor and one as a backup in case the first one got damaged, we begged and pleaded for her to let us have a Debbie. Thankfully, she gave in, but we had to come steal it after dark, at the rear door in an alley. It was like a bank heist. Cut to me and Adam skulking through the back streets of downtown Boston, making our way to his apartment with a one-dimensional Debbie Harry, who stayed upright in the living room for as long as Adam lived there. In 1978, I'd sometimes look at one-dimensional Debbie and wonder what it would be like if I ever had the chance to meet three-dimensional Debbie face-to-face. Would we have chemistry? Would there be heat between us? What would I say? What would I do? Well, cut to me at Radio City circa 2008, and now I knew. I'd be dressed as a woman and just standing there like a dumbfounded fool with 2 erect nipples and 10 sore toes, shrugging. The only heat between us was the smell of another show business dream of mine going up in comedy smoke. Then I heard a man's voice say, hey, dude, I dig those shoes. Turning around, I saw Will.i.am just inches away from me, staring at my stilettos and admiring my glimmery bracelet. He took my wrist in one hand and ran his fingertips along the multiple diamond edges. Nice ice. You look fantastic. And that dress is just killer, baby. I suddenly felt flush and very feminine. I smiled and gushed, thank you, Will. That's so sweet of you to say that. I mean it, man, he said. Love the earrings, too. They make your eyes really pop. I batted my fake eyelashes a little at that remark and giggled a bit and suddenly turned into the world's biggest Black Eyed Peas fan. And then I wondered why he hadn't mentioned my ass yet. Maybe he hasn't seen it, I thought. Turn around, my brain whispered loudly to my body. Give him the full effect. I was in mid-twirl when another part of my brain piped in. What the hell is wrong with you, Dennis, you dim Irish donkey? I had a little interior mini monologue with myself. Hey, asshole, you ain't some hot young chick dressed to the nines and competing with a building full of A-list famous females. You're a man dressed as a woman for a comedy gag you gotta go out and do right now. Wake the fuck up. The outfit and my man vanity were turning me into a seriously insane, attention-seeking mess. Just then, I was yanked out of my reverie and returned to planet Earth when I got my cue and had to head on stage where, once they saw what I was wearing, the audience began to laugh. Like any truly addicted live performer will tell you, the sound of 6,000 people about to bust a gut had me in comedy heaven. Tits or no tits? Smash cut to an hour later. The show's over, and I'm upstairs wearing my own clothes and hanging out with my daughter and her friends, who are very impressed by the evening's entertainment, especially the sight of me in my girlish getup. And Beyonce. I'd almost forgotten about Beyonce. In all the excitement and quick change running around, I realized I'd not only still never met the woman, but, more important, neither had Devin. So once again, we went rushing onto the elevator and down to the first floor, through a maze of hallways and tunnels, until we came into the secret exit area where all the celebs and their entourages would be taking leave for the after party. But instead of leaving, we stood off to the side, awaiting Queen Bey. One by one, celebs came coursing by, each saying, "Hey, Dennis," or "You going to the party?" or some iteration of, "You were great, hilarious, funny as shit tonight." The girls were nervously chattering while I wondered if Beyonce would mention my outfit, still stuck in man vanity land over my girl legs and accoutrement. I planned on not being first to bother her, since she was one of those icons constantly having people interrupt her or besiege her, and we were both celebrities after all, so I'd just play it cool, as if Devin and I were just waiting for someone else. That was plan A. But if she did stop to talk, I'd go right into plan B, which involved me laughing off her positive comments in a modest manner and then telling her how fantastic she was. And then if she insisted on talking some more about my performance, I'd say how great the audience was and mention my writer, Jeff Cesario, and my whole entourage, and then introduce Devin. That seemed like a good plan when Devin walloped me in the arm and hushed into my face, "Dad," and I turned to see Beyonce with about five people behind her as she came down the hallway. And idiotically, I blurted out way too loudly, "Beyonce, you were awesome tonight." She looked up at me and smiled, a beaming smile, a smile that clearly said, "Oh my God, it's you." I've seen that smile after my shows before, from famous people and not so famous people. It's a smile of recognition and appreciation. It's a smile reflecting the joy that person just experienced during my performance. A smile that reprises the happiness I've bestowed upon them with my multifaceted talent, cutting-edge wit, and professional dedication. I was almost beside myself as Beyonce, as if to validate my intuition, blurted out this. "So were you, Brian?" She was still walking. So I said, "Thank you, Beyonce. I love your voice," she said over her shoulder as she and her entourage continued to walk past us. Out the door, into her limo, and drove away. There was an awkward beat as I stood there, still waving. There was another awkward beat as I turned back to Devin and her entourage. The friends didn't know what to say, but Dev did. "Dad, Beyonce thought you were Brian Adams." This was a very important father-daughter situation. How I reacted would not only impact Devin right now, but possibly for years to come, maybe even permanently. And it could also have an effect on how Devin's friends saw her. It was a very delicate moment, what some might call a teachable moment. And so, as a devoted father, I decided to do just that, teach. I thought for a second, looked into my daughter's disappointed eyes and carefully explained, "Hey, it's Beyonce. If she thinks I'm Brian Adams, then I'm Brian fucking Adams, okay? Did you see his performance? He blew the roof off the place. Now come on, let's get our asses over to that after party and see if Brian can get Beyonce to take a fucking picture with you guys." I was teaching them humility and how much of an amoeba fame can actually be. I should have used the word amoeba, then I could have taught them a little science too. Let's face it, if Beyonce ran for president in our next election cycle, Devin and her friends would jump for joy and cast their ballots in advance. As would I. Imagine seeing our State of the Union delivered with a kick-ass chorus and 14 backup dancers. Forget the dignity and decorum of the office. Trump certainly has. So did Bill Clinton. Meanwhile, If President Beyonce sang the Bill of Rights in the Rose Garden one afternoon, every kid in this country would have it memorized by dinner time. Beyonce 2020. Let the drumbeat begin. But Leary 2020? That comedy dream would die under the weight of its own bloated expectations. Because this wasn't the first time I'd been mistaken for someone more talented than me.